put it in a drawer someplace, and have it available for some time in the future. So we all have about 2 years to do that, and you don't have to file at anything, as far as I'm aware, with the FCC. They want you to do the math, and if you find a ridiculous RF exposure, they probably expect you to do something about it, and otherwise they just want that piece of paper someplace. Now, is it theoretically possible that they'll never ask you? Probably. Is it theoretically possible that even if they ask you, if you do it the day before they request you to send it to them, will they care? Probably not. The ARRL will no doubt have some pages where, or they'll refer you to other people with scripts where you can plug in the numbers and get out the results of RF exposure. Okay, are any of those forms that you have to record, are any of them available on the net now or in public? The last time I looked was about 3 weeks ago. The ARRL, if you do a Google search and you include ARRL, they will have a page explaining pretty much what I just said. They will also direct you to a third party that does have the equations up, and you can plug them in and you can print them out. I've been told by third parties, who are not part of the ARRL, but speak to know these guys, that they're working on something internal, that they'll have a similar type of an internal web page available, so you just punch in the numbers and they'll present it in a way that you might be able to just download it and print it at your leisure. I have not seen that come to fruition, but if you do a search for RF exposure, ARRL, chances are you'll come up with the proper page that was sent into the third party that has done all the equations. Like I said, the specifications go all the way back to the 1990s, so none of these equations are something that we didn't know about. We just didn't have to do much about it until now. Okay, very good. Yeah, I really appreciate that, that info. But, those 2 years are going to fly by, and then something is going to be in the corner. Okay, so thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
K2R1.
Yes, David.
I was on that page 2 days ago. I calculated my HF antenna RF. RF from the antenna radiation is 1.3 feet. 1.3 feet is the distance from the antenna.
Okay, well, I don't think they want the particularly the distance. They want the RF exposure.
Well, the idea is the exposure exists according to what the specification is, 1.3 feet from the antenna or less.
Okay, so that's the guidelines. It has to do with the gain of the antenna and the watts outputted from the transmitter.
So, comment?
Yes, please, comment.
Yeah, I think that what it's going to lead to is probably like either an electric field strength in volts per meter or power density in milliwatts, watts, or microwatts per square meter, something like that. Some kind of reading along that line.
Yeah, I would agree. Again, most of these specifications are 20, 30 years old, so they're out there. If they've been included in the ARRL's own website, that's great. Otherwise, you know, worst comes to worst, you go to the third-party people, and they want to know the RF energy and the distance from the closest human being, so that they don't want people unduly irradiated by your transmission, including the operator. Okay, very good. So once again, you all have about 23 months to look it up and calculate it, because you know, they made it extremely obvious that the need to possess this is 2 years after the law went into effect, and the law went into effect last month. So I wish you all well, and maybe if I can find the link to the ARRL during Paul's presentation, I will include it on my link page. So let's move on to the next person, Raymond, AD2BYY. Do you have a question or topic tonight?
Yes, this is Raymond, RKD2BYY. I'm just updating you from the information we discussed last week on the 23-centimeter antenna.
Oh, okay. How's it going?
Well, I found the source of the problem. Looks like it's the repeater book. Android app doesn't agree with the repeater book website, which then doesn't agree with Metro Core services or the FCC. Just so everyone's aware, what it was is that it tells me what the downlink frequency is. It specifies the uplink frequency, which is approximately 20 megahertz off, 20 megahertz negative. But the reported offsite should have been at 12. So if you use Metro Core services, that information is correct.
Okay, it's good to know at least someone got it right. You know, I mean, that's sort of a problem with the repeater list in general. When I first was interested, I was deeply confused. The repeater lists that are available on websites will list hundreds of different repeaters in this metropolitan area. And if you try them, most of them don't even chunk back at you. So I was deeply confused until I kind of fathomed what was going on, that it's relatively easier to get a frequency allocation for a repeater than it is to know that the repeater has been retired. Most people who retire their repeaters, and you don't have to file anything, and you don't have to pay any fee, just keep on having the allocation for those frequencies, and they keep showing up on the damn repeater list. There's a lot of dead repeaters out there on the repeater list, and there's a lot of errors on the repeater list. It took me the better part of, I think, 4 years to get them to change the full sign of a club repeater. That full sign wasn't even active for 10 years. It took a long, long time, so the wheels grind exceedingly slow.
I agree. I just wanted to make sure that I brought back the correct information for everybody, whoever is interested in working within the 23 centimeters.
Okay, very good, Raymond. My understanding, though, was that presently Weimark's 23 centimeter repeater is bound for repair.
That I understand also. That's part of the problem. I wasn't able to actually prove it on our repeater at the 23 centimeters. So hopefully when it comes up, the information I got from the FCC and from Metro Core Services, I'll be able to prove 100%. But right now, the repeater book Android and the repeater book website right now conflicts with each other.
Oh, well, what can I tell you? You can't believe even things that are written down. So I wish you good luck with that, Raymond. I hope you find other... have you had better success using other 23-centimeter repeaters? I've never really dipped my toe in 23 centimeters. I've had more than enough with 2 and 70 centimeters.
No, this was my first attempt to get into it, and I ran into a couple of confusing issues, so how to program up the radio to actually do it. The other information on this, with repeater book, all of the 23 centimeters in our area, up to about 100 miles, has the same type of information. They call out the frequency, downlink frequency, they define the uplink frequency, which is, if you do the math, is not what they're calling the offset frequency. So they have, I can see it's not being used quite a bit because I can't be the first one to catch this and to report it.
No, I'm sure other people have, like I've told you. We had a problem with another club where they were identifying us by a long canceled call sign. And it took many years of frustration. Finally, I basically talked the web poster guy into changing it on the website, which is where everyone was getting the data anyway. So I kind of went around the committee to the guy who just codes the web pages. But it worked.
All right, thanks for the information, and I'll pass it back on to you for the next person.
Okay, good luck, Raymond. David, KG2RY, do you have a question or a topic for tonight?
QSL, Roy. First, I want to say Happy Father's Day to all the fathers. And I have this thing I discovered. This is my experiment. What I did was went on to see if there's any activity in the band of 20 meters. I go from top to bottom in 10 kilohertz increments. I don't hear anything, so I go in between. I hear a couple of weak signals, so I press the antenna tuner. I press the tuner, and the signal comes up. And then, you know, I tune around more and more signals, I start to hear them, you know. My question for you, is this possible? And I spoke to a couple of other people about it. They believe that it is possible. When you tune your transmitter to the antenna, you're also enabling your reception more so. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what you mean by tune your transmitter. In the old days, if you had a tube-based transmitter, it has a PI network, and it basically is its own built-in antenna tuning circuit. Usually they were PI networks. So in that case, yeah, when you tune the final output stage for 50 ohms, pretty much also tuning your input for your receiver. Modern day transistors usually do not have a variable antenna tuner built in. And some do, but some don't. But that's true. If you use any kind of a tuning system to tune the impedance to match the 50 ohm nominal in your radio, you're going to get a better signal on your receiver. Bend wave ratio is less important for reception than for transmission. You can get away with a mismatch. You just have a lower signal level. With a transmitter, you'll have reflections that'll kill things. So you can tolerate a mismatch, but it's always better to have no mismatch even for reception. You'll get the best signal transfer from your antenna system to your front end to your receiver.
QSL, I pressed the tuner button on the antenna tuner. LDTAT100 Pro 2 Auto Tuner. Very small tuner, 125 watts maximum. And I listened for the very loud DX signals coming through. But, you know, it starts out, you know, you don't hear anything, Why people say, you know, they turn on their radio, they tune up and down the band, and then they just give up and say, the propagation is, you know, I say that you have to listen. If you listen, you know, maybe you'll hear.
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways and different methods that different people like. I have gotten blissfully used to a band adapter. It's very nice to be able to visually get a good sense. It's not a
complete set of the band because my antennas are not globally resonant. I do have a band dipole that's sort of resonant on each of the bands because each of the elements operate differently. But I still when I hit the antenna tuner, the signal level will go up and the signals will be better defined. So I sort of visually see where signals are. I discussed this with a guy who's very smart, has 50 plus years in his hobby, and he hated that idea. He would agree with you that the only way, well, I'm not saying that you say this, but he kind of said the only way you can really find a weak signal is by listening closely and turning the dial. So, but to me, both things work to different levels of enjoyment. So, but yeah, you don't quite know what's there until you've resonated your antenna as best you can. You'll have the best signal strength, and weak signals will rise up above the noise level.
Well, you know, Roy, when I go through this process and the signals start coming up, I'm really listening for the loud station ease of communication, like, you know, having a speaker you can hear very clearly, you know, no real interference, no real noise. A lot of times, you know, there's QRM and QSB, but, you know, in the beginning it starts out nice and loud and clear, and I really don't look for weak stations. I would rather just have an easy conversation. Go ahead.
Okay, you know, I mean, again, different strokes for different folks. I mean, there are guys out there who live and die for QRP. They prefer the challenge of a weak signal. A lot of them bone up on their Morse code, or they just jump to their computer for MC8 or such. And they just prefer the challenge of that. I can certainly understand where a strong signal is the easiest on one's ears. It's rather fatiguing to reconstruct what the guy on the other end is saying if they're very, very close to the noise floor.
QSL. Different strokes for different folks. When I was first got my radio telephone license, I was operating 99% CW. It was great. And also 100 watts in a dipole. 100 watts in a dipole. Look what you can do with that.
Yeah, Morse code, you know, Morse code was the first digital transmission design. It has a very long throw. It has a very narrow bandwidth. So the signal is compressed, you know, all those 100 watts are compressed in much, much narrower bandwidth, which makes it a much more effective transmission mode than single sideband or amplitude modulation or frequency modulation.
Yeah, it was the big rag shoe on CW, you know, and I guess that was a big thrill, you know, to be a ham radio operator, to have, you know, a decent privilege, you know, and to be able to make these contacts. Back then, the propagation was amazing. But I wouldn't say the propagation is bad now.
Well, everything ebbs and flows. You know, it's not like people remembering the good old days. We're dealing with the same laws of physics, so it's a matter of radio noise in your area. The frequency bands that you tend to like to use are different, have different effects for the ionization, for where we are in the sunspot cycle. For those people who love to talk on 75 meters, not having much in the way of sunspot activity hasn't affected them at all. For people who talk about the good old days of talking on 6 or 10, those are will hopefully soon come. They have predicted that the peak of the next sunspot cycle, number 25, will be in about 5 years. So, you know, every year it will get a little bit better,
And Bill, finally, 5 years from now, we'll be able to tell big stories to each other, how we talked around the world on 6 meters or 10 meters. So it's always been. It's a cyclical thing. Some of it is predictable. A lot of it isn't predictable. I tend to think that most hams ultimately prefer it that way. If it was a consistent thing that was reliable 24/7, a lot of them would probably equate it with their cell phone. And some of the glamour would fade.
Well, Roy, I was licensed many years ago. I was licensed in the mid-70s. And it took me this long to get to where I am now. So, you know, it's a whole tremendous learning process, I think.
Well, I mean, ultimately, life itself, hopefully, is a learning process. I try to learn a couple of things new, you know, every day, if not every hour.
That's why I'd like to talk about lettuce next. Lettuce and carrots.
You got to figure out what you want in your life. If you don't know what you want, how can you get what you want? And if you don't know what you want, there's no way you can get what you want. KG2R1.
Okay, very good, David. I think that was Rich W2BZ talking about lettuce and carrots.
It was, Alan. So I don't know when the science section is going to start, so my funny little way of, which is actually the subject of what I want to ask you, that was the reason for it. I'm in no rush. I can sit here till 1 in the morning. But when the science part of it comes in, I have a question. W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. Things have been lively, thank God. We have 4 more people on the launch pad. We did 4 people before this. So we had 8 people sign in, including you now. That makes you make 8. So hold on. I'm sure we'll get to you.
Tomatoes, too.
Okay, I'll pencil in tomatoes, too. Next on my list is Hank, N1YDY. Hank, hopefully you're still with us. What's your question or your topic tonight?
Good evening and happy Father's Day to all. I have a question about altitude versus gain. So my question is, given limited access to the roof and the need to hide the antenna from the HOA, am I better off with a ground plane hidden in a cupola physically on the roof, or with a high gain antenna that's approximately 16 to 17 feet lower mounted on a balcony?
What bands are we talking about?
I'm sorry, I meant 2 meters.
So you're talking about the 2 meter antenna, right?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, I'm reminded that Dick, may rest in peace, you know, has this line, or mine is close to his line. You know, there are 3 important things with UHF and VHF. Elevation, elevation, and elevation.
Yeah, I've heard that, but again, the putting up a collinear high gain antenna on the balcony that I'm thinking of for the old Cushcraft Air XTV that I would put up and take down versus hiding the ground plane in the cupola that is physically shielded by the cupola itself, the wooden cupola.
Yeah, I understand. Let me see if I have it. Okay. Yeah, I understand. Well, I mean, the problem is that all things being equal, elevation has the most dramatic effect. Stacking separate antennas on top of each other to increase the gain can be somewhat effective. The problem, though, is that it's probably more of an obstruction. It depends on where your balcony is related, is in relation to the repeaters that you're planning to hit. You might ultimately be better with a smaller, lower gain with more elevation simply because you have to deal with less obstruction. It's theoretically possible that it could be a draw, or the isolinear could be better than the small hit one at a higher altitude. I have tried all kinds of non-altitude means of getting away with the laws of physics because it's a pain in the backside for me to get it on the roof. I've tried amplifiers. I've tried high gain antennas. I've tended to find that altitude makes it a remarkably better antenna. So I've noticed ridiculous things like 25, 30 decibel gain by lifting them 30 feet. You know, in my area, there's a lot of houses attached to each other. So it's like everything is shielded down in the ground.
All right, guys. I appreciate the input. And I'm sort of coming to that conclusion slowly, but I'm hoping to find someone to say something different. It's a lot easier to run the wire than one thing. I think I'm going to end up trying to sleep on the roof. So with that, thank you very much. And we're going to wait there.
I wish you luck, Hank. If I ever figure out how to successfully break the laws of physics, I'll let you in on the secret. How's that? Okay, Charlie, KD2WIW, you have a question, right? I'll try one more time. Charlie might have walked away from the radio since last he checked in. Charlie, KD2WIW. Do you have a question tonight? Okay, I guess we'll go back to Charlie later on. Maybe he'll return to us. Next on the list, Wesley, you wanted to discuss one of my favorite antenna designs, magnetic loops.
Thank you very much. A few information on this session. The magnetic loop consists of a conductive loop that is separated at one end by capacitor, thus transforming the circuit that has to resonate at the operating frequency of an antenna. It has two loops. It could have more loops, but two loops. A smaller loop is positioned towards the opposite end of the capacitor within the area of the main larger loop. This smaller loop is connected to the transfer via impedance match feed line. Both the small and large loop are magnetically coupled and form a transformer. During a transmission, the small loop would induce high frequency AC current into the larger loop, then in turn would radiate the RF signal. During a reception, the RF signal is picked up by larger loop and current is induced into the smaller loop, which is feed line into the receiver. So we have air transformer. If you look at the Tesla coil, it does have also two coils. One is a large coil, high voltage, one is small one, and it's also a transformer. The problem that I have with it is polarization. Is it really a vertically polarized? And to explain.
Well, there's a couple things that I just add to the mix. You can use the inductive coil is an impedance matching circuit. So, like other antennas that have impedance matching circuits, it doesn't have to be an inductive matching circuit. And people have built truly magnetic loops that use gamma matches, which are not inductors, and although they transform the impedance, they are not what I would call a transformer, in the way that you're describing. So there's more than one way of spinning a magnetic loop. I tend to think of magnetic loops not as some kind of magical thing that only receives magnetic field waves, but they're just short dipoles that are distorted in a circular shape with a tuning a capacitor at the edges. For the most part, I believe that the polarization is very similar to vertical. It's probably a much more complicated a polarization angle than a simple linear one, but the closest variation is vertical, just the way it seems to respond in real use. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a inductively driven antenna. You can use other impedance matching circuits like gamma matches to do the same thing.
Yes. Well, let me put it how I understand that. Magnetic loop is essentially a small loop antenna with circumference is less than one-tenth of the wavelength. And that magnetic loop couples to the magnetic field of the radio wave in the region near antenna, in the contrast to monopole or dipole, which couple to the electric field of the wave when receiving the oscillating magnetic field of the incoming radio wave induces a current in the loop by Faraday law induction. It is a transformer. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes. You could call it a transformer if you like. I think, once again, it confuses the issue. It is that you would also have to say that a gamma match is a transformer. And a gamma match doesn't work anything like inductively coupled circuits.
Yeah, you got a point. However, during a transmission, the small loop would induce the high-frequency AC current into the larger loop, and that in turn would radiate the RF signal. And during reception, that RF signal is picked up by larger loop, and the current induced into the small loop, which is fed into the receiver. But, okay, it's a semantic, or maybe not, or maybe it is a transformer. I just thought, is it really vertical polarization? The elements are vertical, but it is a DLC circuit, and it's extremely narrow, so if you don't have the automatic tuning, and it goes for, I don't know, it could go for three times the bandwidth of a single sideband. So it will be 2.4, 2.4, 2.43, three times to the left, three times to the right, which is good for the receiving, let's say. Because if you're dealing with the area that you have extremely high presence of any other interference, then this is absolutely excellent. And by the way, if you're using it for receiving, you can simply, a little bit untuned, but it's extremely sharp. And when you untune that, you're actually making your signal a little bit less strong, but everything else is that quiet. And to exit.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem with things like magnetic loops, by definition, are approximately their circumference is somewhere around one-tenth of a wavelength. You know, as it gets closer and closer to a full wavelength, it has completely different properties and different polarization angles. such, but with a magnetic loop, it has a very IQ and a very narrow bandwidth. It is not terribly well suited for people who either change frequency a lot or don't mind adjusting their tuning. For the sake of just pure reception, you can get away with murder with an antenna tuner, a magnetic loop rather. As I mentioned sort of earlier, that receiver front ends are far more forgiving for a impedance mismatch. So it is theoretically possible, and I did own a magnetic loop that was locked into a certain tuning system. You could tune it. It was frozen. But it also included a high-gain receive preamp. So you could use it over 10 to 80 meters. It had reasonable results. If you tuned it, would it have much better results? Yeah, but it had passable results. So the plus is that it's small, it's compact, it's portable. It doesn't require any degree of height. The downside is it's very high Q and narrow bandwidth. And if you want to transmit high power, the capacitor that's used has to be very expensive because the breakdown voltage becomes enormous for high power transmission.
And some addition. This event. When transmitting, let's say, 100 watt power, the current within the large loop would amount to several amps, while the voltage across the capacitor will be in the order of kilovolts. The high voltage requires quite large air capacitor with adequate separation between the plates. And then a magnetic loop has, this is old style. I remember that from the Soviet time, from 60s, 70s. When I was just a young boy, let me just and since the antenna is typically located several meters away from the radio operator, it must be the way to remotely tune the variable capacitor. This has been achieved by attaching the standard RC grade servo. There were something that was the Soviet style, how do they call it, you turn a little bit one motor and then that the other motor shaft is turning gas, cello, whatever, forget the name, getting old. So right now they have some sort of electronic that is doing it. They have Arduino Pro Mini, if I recall it. So there are new ways, or Celsin, that was a Celsin. Celsin, that was the name of the dual motor. You connect two motors together, you turn the shaft of one, and the other one is turned at the same degree. And to experience.
Well, yes, I mean, the fundamental design of the magnetic loop has not changed in 60, 70, 80 years. It's a short loop with a capacitor connected between the gap and some kind of matching circuit feeding and drawing out the received power. What is changing to a degree are the electronics involved in auto-tuning for those who don't want to. It's true that they're also very affected by vocal pieces of metal. Conductors can disrupt the functioning of a magnetic loop. So you want to put a little bit of distance between anything and an antenna loop, a magnetic loop, and certainly yourself, because you don't want to be exposed to that RF. But there are people who get up from their chair and they go over there and they tune it and they listen for the audio, and when they hear the loudest noise from their receiver, they judge it to be relatively close to resonance, and they go back and see what's happening. But there are manufacturers who are building all kinds of very interesting devices. There's a company called Precision RF that have built, I think it was Raspberry Pi, controllers of all kinds. They have different power ratings They go from something like 25 watts, I think, at the low end, all the way to a 1.5 kilowatt output. They use a monstrous vacuum capacitor in order to handle the severe voltage differential that the two sides of the magnetic loop.
Yeah. There is another product ready to use. I believe it's $370-something. The Camelon antenna loop 2.0. The good thing is that the loop is made from quadruped, so it's very easy to for portable communication. And they sell it also with backpacks. Somebody is interesting. And that lady, you saw the video. She is great. If you can say a few words.
Yeah, Jerry, I remember Jerry is. You remember her last night?
Jerry, just a moment. I had it open somewhere. Jerry. No? Oh, cannot find it. Let me go to my email that I emailed to you. I should have it. Hold on.
Okay, until you come back, I'll just... This woman's a very smart woman. She kind of taught herself electrical engineering, which is sort of tough to do. I believe she started off pretty much fixing pinball machines. And she's just worked her way all the way up. She's had a couple of businesses. Unfortunately, I'm not quite sure her business capabilities. She's a very good electrical engineer, but the business has kind of failed. She's right now working on some kind of virtual vision game device, but she sporadically puts the things on YouTube, and about 2 or 3 years ago, she had an excellent YouTube where she was able to show that the voltage increases across a magnetic loop, gets higher and higher until it gets to the edges where the tuning capacitor are, and she also had a current detector that showed that the maximum of current is at the feed line for the inductive matching circuit. So she demonstrated, which is a common thing for pretty much every antenna. If you take a common dipole, its current peaks are at the feed line, and its voltage peaks are at the edges of the dipole. The problem, along with other things that I have with guys who talk about magnetic loops, and this included Ham Radio University, guys like to say that magnetic loops have a constant voltage and a constant current, which goes against Jerry's YouTube and my understanding of physics. And I talked to Dick about this very subject, and what I was able to glean is that was more of a theoretical response from people. As you bring the circumference of the magnetic loop closer and closer to 0 inches, it approaches a constant voltage and a constant current. But obviously, you can't really do that with a real live magnetic loop. They don't work with a zero circumference. So there's always going to be a non-constant voltage and current. And Jerry, got a last name, but I'm sure Wesley will tell me right after I unkey. Was able to demonstrate very nicely in the YouTube. I may very well have posted that on one of my previous links, but I'll post it again tonight.
It's Jerry Ellsworth. She is on YouTube. It's her channel. What your time, every second of your time. It is worth. Now, comparing the two of them, well, she doesn't make mistakes, and she doesn't give incorrect information. I'm not trying to make a bad word about HRO, but That's my opinion. And to exit.
I agree with you on most of it. She's a very smart electrical engineer. Again, I don't think I would invest money in her business machines because, as far as I'm aware, she's zero for two at this point, but it could be more that never really took off. I've had disagreements with people in Ham Radio University. I presented at Ham Radio University, so what the hell? I can throw a rock if I live in a glass house as well. There was once a guy who did a presentation who didn't want to go into detail, kept on saying that the ionosphere reflects RF waves. They do reflect them, but they also refract them, which is a little different than reflect them. So, yeah, I've had problems with a bunch of people at Ham Radio University. There's still probably a YouTube up from a very nice guy who really did a terrible presentation on how antenna work, to the point where he explained that one end of a dipole was the ground.
Hi, for Paul, please.
Well, I thank you for your opinion, but as I said, Paul is 10:15. This is 9:49. So I'm sorry. So there are other people who have questions that they want to ask. So you'll have to bide your time, I'm afraid.
And what was his call sign? Sir, do you have a call sign?
Anonymous.
Okay, I'm not going to make anybody angry. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. It's just happening every Sunday. Every Sunday somebody without a call sign is calling for space report or anything else. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
You're always welcome here, Wes. Let me ask if Charlie is out there and listening. KD2WIW. Are you out there, Charlie? Oh, well. We'll give another chance. Rich, W2BZ, you have a question related to tomatoes, lettuce, and carrots?
Yes, and all the other vegetables that I hate. For some reason, at my young age of 72, I'm getting interested in my health. It's taken a while, but I'm getting interested in my health. And about 10 years ago, or a little bit more than that, there was this fad of juicing, if you remember, Roy, where they would take, carrots and celery and all this other stuff and put it through a blender that would extract the pulp and just leave the juice. And then there was another called a masticating juicer where it would take very fine leafy vegetables that were too fine and it would actually push the vegetables against the screen and therefore squeeze out the goodies inside the vegetables. Anyway, I got back interested in it, and but this time I bought myself a sort of a combination of both machines. And basically, it's what they make, what's all the rage now, let me just drop it a second. Smoothies. They're called smoothies, okay? And there is, in Manhattan, every other block or every four blocks, there's a smoothie store where you can get a combination of cucumber and lettuce and this and that, and it just tastes wonderful. They throw in some raspberries and blah, blah, blah. So I started getting interested in that. Now, in the days of the blenders and all that, I heard that all the not all of the, but a lot of the nutrients that are in the skin that are not getting into the juice are you're losing. So it's not the greatest of nutritional benefits. But here I am throwing everything but the kitchen sink into this thing, and I mean cucumber with apple, with raspberries, with spinach, celery, even lettuce, and I'm enjoying it thoroughly. But this is a different thing. When you finish this, there's nothing left in the canister. In other words, you drink it all. And I'm just wondering, from a nutritional standpoint, since you're not throwing out the pulp, you're drinking the pulp, is it more beneficial, less beneficial, or how much less beneficial than eating the real McCoy?
Okay, so ultimately the question is, which is healthier, eating the whole thing chopped up or just chomping down and doing the maceration yourself?
That's correct, because I would never eat lettuce by itself. Even if it was floating in a sea of salad dressing, I would never eat lettuce. But I throw lettuce into one of these mixtures, and it's very palatable. So I'm thinking after I drink a concoction of this stuff that it may not be as good as eating the lettuce whole, a wedge of lettuce, but I just ate a whole chunk, I just drank a whole chunk of lettuce. So that's the question. How much less effective is it to be drinking vegetables and fruits rather than eating them?
ACCGS, by the way. I would think that the only way that the material is slightly degraded is by the heat produced by the machine maceration. High temperatures can break down complex compounds. I don't think that that's a big problem. I don't think the temperatures go that high and last for that long. I might be wrong. You might want to play games with thermometers and look into that aspect. I would imagine the deterioration, if you let it stand, then probably it will deteriorate at a faster rate than when it is not macerated. But as long as you do a quick maceration with a machine and then consume it, you pretty much will get the value of most of the organic compounds that you're looking for.
Do you know what temperature would be like a demarcation line of being too hot to be of any benefit or really reduce the benefit of liquefying vegetables and fruits?
In practical terms, unfortunately not. It's more of an experimental process. You take the samples, you run them at different specific temperatures for specific durations. You know, if it was a matter of, say, an additional 30 or 40 degrees Fahrenheit for less than a minute, I don't think it would destroy too much in the way of the organic compound. If you were talking about something semi-ridiculous, like 212 degrees Fahrenheit for 10 minutes, yeah, that's going to knock some things apart.
So as long as you're ingesting the pulp along with the rest of the fruit or vegetable, it's a much better way to go than a juice extractor, which extracts the pulp, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you're necessarily starting out with more. I mean, even if some of it degrades because of having it sit there for too long or what have you, 50% or 60% or 70% is certainly better than 0%, so yeah.
What I do, you know, after I finish one of these things, which fills me up, by the way, I could have a whole meal of one of these concoctions, I said, you know, I just ate two cucumbers, you know, a quarter of a wedge of lettuce, and some bunch of blueberries. preparations and sour cream or whatever mixture I throw in there, they all seem to taste, well, much, much better than the raw product itself. And I said, when's the last time I ate two cucumbers? You know what I mean? So it has to be better than nothing, I guess, is my question. I was just wondering if it's a, you know, that sometimes we talk about that gentleman on YouTube who's that Olympic decathlon person or whatever, and his point of view on it is it's a waste of time. You might as well be drinking a malted, even if you're not adding any sugar. Go ahead.
Okay, you know, what can I tell you? He has a right to his opinion. He doesn't have any actual academic degrees for his opinion. Keep in mind that this is a guy who thinks that the genetically modified organism combined with your gut bacteria and produce monster cells that will take over the earth. So you got to keep that in mind with him as well.
Adds 3 or 4 minutes to my life, it's worth it, correct?
Yeah, or if it makes the quality of your life a wee bit better, that's good too.
If that is the real acid test of it, then all right. I just wanted to ask you that question. I keep on forgetting to ask it of you. And just one thing about magnetic loops, the reason why they're talked about every week and they're such a phenomenon is because of their size. You know, there's really nothing magical about them. It's just the shape and the size. And when somebody comes up a cheap way to tune them, I'll bet you they would sell like MFJ would be finally becoming the great company, the great empire they've always set out to be. Anyway, thanks, Roy. Whiskey 2, Bravo 2.
You're welcome, Rich. As far as the magnetic loops, unfortunately, the two kind of Achilles heels that magnetic loops designed have. Okay, I should be back on high power. Magnetic loops have two problems. One, as you mentioned, is the high Q, very, very narrow bandwidth. The other is the power handling capacity. That $300 magnetic loop that Wesley mentioned earlier from Chameleon is a 25-watt transmitter. You can't operate past 25 watts. A lot of people really would like to have an antenna that they could throw 100 watts out at.
Yeah, you need to be at the height of the sunspot cycle to really enjoy something like that, I would think. At the height of the sunspot cycle, a couple of which I've been through, and they are a lot of fun. But you would need something like that for low power. And God bless the person who puts 1,000 watts into a magnetic loop.
Well, it's possible for you guys out there with $3,000 plus to drop. Precision RF has a monster vacuum capacitor that's rated at something ridiculous like 1.5 kilowatts. But just as an aside, as far as nutrition is concerned, like drugs and a lot of other things, you have to basically consider the risk versus benefit. If the risk of taking something is negligible and the benefit is questionable, then it's a reasonable thing to try. If the risks are great, if it costs $1,000 a dose, or if 1 out of 1,000 people grows a tail, then with a questionable benefit, then it's a bad situation. But with a lot of nutrition and supplements, a lot of times it's that the risks are negligible and the benefits are not obvious and not totally proven, but, you know, if you got a couple of bucks to spend on vitamins, you know, no one's going to go particularly poor on vitamins. So, you know, I can understand why people do that. So that's my 2 cents worth on, you know, different methods of nutrition and stuff. That you have to look at it as a risk-benefit type of thing.
Just back to the magnetic loop just for a second.